This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, the exodus from private health insurance continues. And will the Australian government ever reopen the door to Chinese telco Huawei?
We still await actually written confirmation and reasons. But no, listen, we don't hold out hope that the ban will be lifted in the near term.
To breaking news, and Cardinal George Pell has lost his appeal against historical child sexual abuse charges. Last December, Australia's most senior Catholic was convicted of abusing two choir boys at Melbourne St Patrick's Cathedral. He was sentenced to 6 years jail in March. The Victorian Court of Appeal dismissed the Cardinal's argument that the jury's verdict was unreasonable and two other technical arguments about the running of his trial. Here's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Victoria, Anne Ferguson, announcing the court's decision.
The Court of Appeal has dismissed Cardinal Pell's appeal against his conviction for the commission of sexual offences. He will continue to serve his sentence of 6 years imprisonment. He will remain eligible to apply for parole after he has served 3 years and 8 months of his sentence. Whether Cardinal Pell will be released on parole will be a matter for the Adult Parole Board, not the courts.
And that's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Victoria, Anne Ferguson. Samantha Donovan is at the court and she joins us now. Samantha, good morning. Why did the court reach this decision?
Well, Sabra, this hasn't been a unanimous decision. It's been a 2-1 decision by the Victorian Court of Appeal. Chief Justice Anne Ferguson, who we just heard from, and the President of the Victorian Court of Appeal, Chris Maxwell, have dismissed the Pell appeal, whereas Justice Mark Weinberg said that he accepted one of the arguments of Pell's appeal team. So essentially, the two judges in the majority have decided that it was open to the jury to find Cardinal Pell guilty of these offences committed at Melbourne's St Patrick's Cathedral in the mid-1990s. There were three grounds of appeal, Sabra, and the first one was that the jury verdict was unreasonable, and that's been the focus of the court's ruling this morning. As I said, the two judges in the majority have found that it was open to the jury. They pointed out that there were 13 points raised by Pell's defence team as being impediments or reasons why he shouldn't have been convicted. They've dismissed all 13 of those arguments and they've accepted that the complainant in this case, who was really the only witness to give evidence in relation to the offences. There are about 20 other witnesses who said it either didn't happen or couldn't have happened, but they've found him to be a truthful and compelling witness. As I mentioned, Justice Mark Weinberg disagreed, though. He found that there was scope for the jury to find that there were problems with the complainant's evidence. As I mentioned, there were 13 impediments that Pell's team argued, and Justice Ferguson, Chief Justice Ferguson, this morning has outlined one of those grounds just by way of explanation. This was an argument that it was impossible for Cardinal Pell, or Archbishop Pell as he was at the time, to commit the offences because the robes he was wearing at the time as Archbishop were just too heavy. Pell's team argued that it was just impossible for him to have abused the boys in the sacristy of the cathedral. But Chief Justice Ferguson and Justice Maxwell have both cited that as one example. They found that by looking at the robes themselves, feeling them, that it was possible for Pell to manoeuvre the robes and abuse the boys.
Let's now hear a little bit more from the Chief Justice of the Court, Anne Ferguson, in handing down today's decision.
There has been vigorous and sometimes emotional criticism of the Cardinal, and he has been publicly vilified in some sections of the community. There has also been strong support for the Cardinal by others. Indeed, it's fair to say that this case has divided the community. It is important to stress at the outset that Cardinal Pell's conviction only concerns the five offences alleged to have been committed by him. Again, as the trial judge observed, he is not to be made a scapegoat for any perceived failings of the Catholic Church, nor for any failure in relation to child sexual abuse by other clergy.
That is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Victoria, Anne Ferguson, and our reporter Samantha Donovan is still at the court. How did George Pell react, Sam?
He was fairly expressionless, Sabra. He was brought into court this morning from the cells, having come from the Melbourne Assessment Prison this morning. It was quite unusual in that the decision was announced virtually from the get-go, and he sat very quietly. He at times sort of smoothed down his hair. He rested his face in his hand and listened to the judges as they gave their explanation. I should point out there were two other grounds that the Pell team tried to argue. If the unreasonableness of the jury decision argument didn't succeed, there were two technical grounds that Pell's team put forward as well. One, they argued, was that the trial judge should have allowed the jury to see an animation of the movements around the cathedral. The third ground related to the way that Pell was arraigned in front of the jury. That is how he pleaded not guilty. But the court has rejected both of those grounds, not even considering them as part of the appeal. They refused leave to appeal. So the hearing has been winding up. Cardinal Pell was taken back to the cells. He'll be taken back to prison. And as Chief Justice Ferguson pointed out, he now has to wait to apply for parole. He's got 3 years, 8 months of that 6 years sentence before he can apply for parole. I'm standing in the Supreme Court courtyard and there is a helicopter overhead. So obviously some of the news channels are looking to follow his prison van back to jail.
Samantha, was there much reaction at the court?
There was actually, Sabra. The decision was being broadcast. People could watch it on their phones and it was on delay. So while we were in the courtroom, a few minutes or a few seconds, I should say, about 15 to 20 seconds after the decision was announced, we could hear a cheer go up from outside on the footpath where lots of people had gathered to make their feelings known about Cardinal Pell, whether they're supporters or against him. It was very quiet in the courtroom, but certainly arriving at court today, massive banks of media, cameras, and lots of people standing out front to find out what was going on, and big queues too to get into the public gallery of the court.
Okay, Samantha Donovan, our reporter at the Supreme Court of Victoria, thank you. To cries of ditch the bill, anti-abortion campaigners rallied outside the New South Wales Parliament last night, boasting they have the people power to ensure legislation to decriminalise abortion in the state gets voted down. Their hopes have been buoyed by Premier Gladys Berejiklian's decision to delay an upper house vote on the bill until next month. Leaders of Sydney's Catholic and Anglican churches and the Australian Christian Lobby urged the crowd to pressure MPs to vote down the legislation. Nick Grimm reports.
It bore all the hallmarks of a victory celebration.
When I say pro, you say life! Pro! Life!
For those gathered in Sydney's Martin Place last night, the day had brought a reprieve from laws designed to bring New South Wales in line with the rest of the nation. The crowd, determined to ensure the state remains the only jurisdiction where abortion remains an offence under its 113-year-old Crimes Act. Addressing the rally, the Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, Anthony Fisher, condemning those parliamentarians who voted the decriminalisation bill through the state's lower house.
The bill that was introduced to our lower house and now to our upper house is a shameful kill bill.
They say this decriminalises abortion. It decriminalises murder. That's what it does.
The Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, Dr. Glenn Davies, joining his Catholic counterpart along with leaders of the Greek Orthodox and Armenian churches, to urge the crowd to leave no stone unturned in their fight to defeat the bill.
And they've got to answer our prayers and kill this bill. Remember this. You don't work for them, they work for you.
One New South Wales voter heeding the call to arms, National Party federal backbencher Barnaby Joyce, who travelled 6 hours from his New England electorate to address the rally.
Don't just go away and stop. You have to continue on. This fight goes for 3 weeks. It goes for 3 months. It goes for 3 years. It goes for 300 years.
But advocates for the decriminalisation bill remain confident they have the numbers to ensure it's adopted, arguing the delay is merely drawing out the inevitable. Tess Oxley is a Sydney paramedic who lent her voice to the campaign after telling the ABC last month that she's been called to too many emergency cases where women have attempted to abort their unwanted pregnancies themselves.
The delay means that these are still options that women are going to have to look at, and unfortunately, it actually makes things worse because instead of just feeling on your own that perhaps what you're doing is wrong or that the options that you're looking for are wrong, you have large groups of people who are potentially uninformed chanting and yelling that at you. And I just don't see how that can benefit healthcare in any way at all.
Paramedic Tess Oxley ending Nick Grimm's report. A new group has been formed amid the fractious parliamentary debate and public rallies on the abortion bill. The New South Wales Parliamentary Friendship Group on Religious Freedoms held its first meeting this week in Sydney. Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Elton was there. He's the Chief Minister of the Great Synagogue in Sydney, and he joined me earlier. Rabbi Elton, welcome to AM.
Good morning.
What do you make of the delay on the abortion bill? Has there been enough public consultation?
I think it's appropriate that there should be this delay so that there can be more consultation. I think there was insufficient consultation in the first stage, as it were, of the process. So I'm pleased there's now a chance for a greater consultation with different groups in the community.
There was a large public rally last night in Sydney. One MP there was the Federal National backbencher Barnaby Joyce. He's also recorded robocall messages that have been sent out to people saying that the proposed laws are barbaric and that this bill would allow abortion for any reason. Are those fair assessments of what this bill does?
I think the problem has been that the speed of the process has been such that we're not entirely clear what the consequences of the bill will be. I'm very much against any disproportionate response one way or another to the current bill or the current law. It's really time for careful, considered examination of the bill and its consequences so we can get away from the big rhetoric and towards a more sober assessment of what a change in the law could lead to.
Are you comfortable with the tone and tenor of debate so far?
Absolutely not. I think we need to dial down the debate across the board. These are the most serious issues. A woman contemplating an abortion is in the most terrible situation. It's heartrending for her and her family. They don't deserve to have vituperative rhetoric thrown at them. And we're also dealing with very serious issues about human life. So it behooves everybody on all sides and the gravity of the issues to deal with this in a very calm and serious and responsible way.
And political leaders and MPs, what role do they have in dialing that down?
Well, there are leaders. There are political leaders. There are elected representatives. And they have to model that sort of mature and sober deliberation and public conversation.
The federal government will soon present draft laws on religious discrimination. Have you spoken with the Attorney General or someone from the government about what it's planning to do?
I've not spoken to anyone from the government about the plans, no.
Is that disappointing? Would you expect to be briefed before the bills are introduced into Parliament?
Well, I don't think necessarily at that stage, but I hope that as we move forward, I think the Cabinet met yesterday to discuss the issue, that there will now be an opportunity for deliberation in public on the bill. Maybe a draft bill will be published for consultation with the wider community. And then we can all read it and consider and send in our responses. So it's not too late for a consultation. As long as it takes place now, I think that's entirely appropriate.
Yeah, the government is apparently promising the laws will protect people but will not give them a licence to discriminate. How comfortable are you with that?
If that's what the bill does, then I think that's the proper balance. We live in a shared society of people of faith and people without faith, and it's important that each of those groups and the individuals in those groups are able to exercise their own freedoms without infringing on the freedoms of others and can express their own beliefs and views without gratuitous offence to those around them. It's a difficult balance to strike, but I hope that'll be achieved.
Do you believe that religious schools, for example, should be allowed to discriminate?
Depends what you mean by discrimination. So let me take a Jewish example. We have Jewish schools in Australia. For the education of Jewish students, there is an internal Jewish definition of who is a Jew, and Jewish schools should be allowed to admit students according to those criteria in order to create a Jewish school for Jewish students educated in the Jewish faith.
It's really easy to focus on issues that divide communities, Rabbi, but what's your message to the broader community about tolerance?
I think tolerance is absolutely essential if we're going to keep our society together. If you look across the world, look at America, if you look at Europe, society is being horrifically divided by intolerance, by white supremacy, the far left also showing deep intolerance to anyone who disagrees with them. There has to be a strong consensus centre ground where we are committed to treating each other with civility. And I think in Australia we have an excellent start in that direction. That is really the tradition of Australian society. And it's now our job to maintain that.
Rabbi, thanks for talking to AM.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Elton is the Chief Minister of the Great Synagogue in Sydney. Cybersecurity experts and Federal Education Department officials will sit down with universities today to debate new guidelines on collaborative research amid concerns about Chinese influence. It follows on from a meeting we told you about 2 weeks ago. The Federal Education Minister Dan Tehan has set out some boundaries for the discussions during an RN breakfast interview.
It's just a matter of making sure that all research that we do with whatever country is in our national interest. And if that means we need to put markers around certain research, then that's what we'll do.
Meanwhile, a new report out today warns that Australia's universities are too heavily exposed to China and could suffer financially if the number of Chinese students suddenly drops because of an economic downturn. National Education reporter Natasha Robinson has the story.
Law student Abby Shi feels lucky to be attending an Australian university. She's acutely aware of the sacrifices some Chinese families make to pay the fees.
Some of them have to sell like their properties back in China in order to afford their kids to be studying in Australia.
A new report published by the Centre for Independent Studies shows just how popular Australian universities are with foreign students. There were just under 400,000 international students enrolled last year, a number that has doubled since 2008 and more than tripled since 2002. 153,000 were students from China. The report's author is Salvatore Bombonis, an associate professor at the University of Sydney.
Australian universities have a multiple of several times the number of Chinese students of any comparable university in the world.
Those big overseas student numbers provide a lucrative market for Australian unis. Salvatore Bobonis's report shows that the University of Sydney and Melbourne University each reaped an estimated $250 million in revenue from international student fees in 2017. Professor Bobonis says that creates unique risks for the institutions.
The risks are primarily financial. In the global financial crisis in 2008, the world's governments bailed out the biggest banks because they were too big to fail. Well, right now we have a problem where Australia's big universities are too big to fail. You can't let a major metropolitan university go bankrupt, but the major metropolitan universities are trading on that knowledge. They are taking out loans and they're making long-term commitments to staff and to students based on projected revenues that at a moment's notice could disappear. And they could disappear if there's a macroeconomic event involving China and the Chinese currency.
The Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency is the independent body that takes care of quality assurance and the regulation of higher education. Chief Executive Anthony McLaren says it keeps a close eye on whether any higher education providers are overexposed to any single markets.
I think that we do occasionally see patterns of overconcentration on either on international students generally or on students from one country. And in those circumstances, we would always recommend diversification where that's possible.
In a statement, the university sector's peak body, Universities Australia, says the vast majority of Australian universities are classified as low risk financially. The Federal Education Minister, Dan Tehan, also says universities are required by law to be financially viable, and his department monitors the financial performance and position of each university.
Natasha Robinson with the story there. This week marks a year since the telco giant Huawei was banned from the rollout of the 5G network in Australia. Now, in a fresh blow, the United States has specifically added Huawei Australia to its list of entities that American companies are banned from doing business with. John Lord is the chairman of Huawei Australia. He served in the Royal Australian Navy for 36 years, retiring with the rank of Rear Admiral. I spoke with him a short while ago. John Lord, welcome to AM.
Thank you, Saba.
What will the US ban mean for the Australian arm of Huawei?
We're still investigating this, Saba, but at the moment we don't see any great impact on Huawei. It's not just Australia. There was quite a few entities there that the US included in it. Most of our supplies come from the headquarters of the company or from other company outlets outside of the United States. And all of our projects and that we have running at the moment, we have previously, as this trade dispute has gone on, looked at our supply lines and made sure that we've mitigated most risks.
Was it a surprise? Why do you think that Huawei Australia was named by the US?
Well, you have to ask the US government exactly why. Was it a surprise? Well, it was a surprise that we were actually included. Yes, I suppose so. But then probably not a surprise because the US has been lobbying many countries around the world not to use Huawei. And I guess they've been singularly successful. Australia's the only one that's totally banned Huawei in 5G. But then to pick up the rest of the Huawei entities and add them in without any allegation of doing anything wrong, I think just shows that this is really about the trade dispute between China and the US and not a matter of security, as they were saying last year.
So you think this is more about economics, not about national security?
Almost certainly. Sabri, if you go back to last year, it was Huawei. Huawei was so far ahead in 5G, and the US were caught out by that, and therefore started to ask countries not to use Huawei to slow us down. But now you've got all these bans coming on, and who knows what's going to happen next? They change weekly from the US. What happens? It's all to do with the China-US trade dispute. And in fact, there has been mentions that Huawei could be part of a resolution of that dispute. So all we can do is sit back and watch. This is international politics at play.
It's a year this week since Huawei was banned from the 5G rollout in Australia. Top Huawei executives have recently visited Australia to try and lobby the government. Have they had any luck?
When you say top Huawei executives visit to lobby the government, that's not true at all. In fact, the only person that's visited the government since I was informed that we were not going to be part of 5G is me. Now, we have had executive or two out for special conferences. One was an innovation conference, but there's been no lobbying of the federal government.
Right. Realistically, can you see any chance of that ban being overturned?
Not in the short term, Sabra. I think the government's been very clear. It's been repeated by several ministers. We still await actually written confirmation and reasons. But we don't hold out hope that the ban will be lifted in the near term.
Huawei says that there is no way that information would be passed on to the Chinese government. Can you give an ironclad guarantee on that?
Yes, I certainly can. I mean, what people are missing in this is, Huawei could be influenced by the Chinese government. Well, we have a couple of legal opinions, one from London, one from New York, and one from Australia. It says that we're not covered by this. But more importantly, you can test our equipment and our software. Now, testing is not 100% complete, but it's a great risk mitigator used by UK, Europe and Canada at present. And then you can make sure that you've only got qualified Australian staff maintaining the gear. And the third part is Huawei does not deal in data. Huawei is a vendor and provides the equipment. The telcos, the Telstras, VHAs, Optuses carry the data.
But so, how do you get around Chinese law that says all Chinese companies have to cooperate with the government, including, presumably, intelligence agencies?
That's what it says actually in China. But what we're saying is in Australia, no, we don't. We obey the laws of the country and in every other country we're in. And the laws of Australia don't allow that. And the Chinese law does not apply to Huawei Australia.
Can you see your company arguing that if China taps you and says, hello, we want this information, you're obliged to do it?
Well, so, but what someone's got to explain to me, that's what the Chinese government just did in China. How did we Australian employees, 700 of us, do something against Australia's national interest in Australia?
But I'm arguing about that central point. This is Chinese law. You're not immune from it.
Well, we are immune. We have two legal opinions that says it does not apply to us. It definitely does not apply to us outside of China. And as I've said to you, we can put our equipment in. It's operated by telcos who are in Australia, maintained by Australians. And therefore, you know, there is no way in the world any information in Australia will be handed over to any other government, and in any country will be handed over to a foreign government.
What did you make of Liberal MP Andrew Hastie's comments about China?
Mr. Hastie has a right, I guess, to a personal opinion. I appeared before the Joint Committee of Intelligence Security several years ago and gave our evidence, and I hoped that those politicians asking the questions and listening had a reasonably open mind to the information being fed back. I hope when he puts his hat on as chairman of that committee, he sits there with that same open mind. I thought Jeff Ravey wrote a more balanced response the other day, calling, you know, not for these statements of bias or that, but let's have a national discussion where we mix security with trade, with our economy, and let's get a proper national position on this. And I think that's probably a good suggestion.
John Lord, thanks for talking to AM this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Albert.
That's John Lord, the chairman of Huawei Australia. If you've dropped out of private health insurance after deciding it wasn't worth it, it seems you are not alone. New numbers show the percentage of Australians with basic hospital cover has now hit the lowest mark in more than a decade. Tom Eagledon reports.
If you've got private health insurance, you might feel a slight discomfort at new figures from the insurance regulator, APRA. Its examination reveals just over 44% of Australians now have basic hospital cover, the lowest for 12 years, and a full percentage point down from this time last year. Tony Bartoni is the president of the Australian Medical Association, which represents doctors.
We know that young people are deserting private hospital insurance, and that is leaving an ever-increasing and older population, which is very, very costly for the funds to insure and provide coverage for.
That means likely higher premiums for those left in the private health system and a greater burden on public hospitals who have to treat the ex-private patients.
We need to all be very clear that this is not going away and it will only get worse and will get worse quickly without government leadership and intervention.
But the government says it is acting. A statement from Health Minister Greg Hunt says it's already delivered the most significant reforms to private health in over a decade, with more improvements planned. Most of that reform centred on giving private health insurance customers simpler, more transparent information about what they're getting for their cover. Grattan Institute Health Program Director Stephen Duckett says that's a good plan because most of the dropouts come after patients make a claim.
And it costs them thousands of dollars often. Out of pocket, which they were not anticipating. And then they get really, really annoyed. And this is what doesn't help the health insurance industry. People find that they're not well covered and they start to drop out.
But Tony Bartoni of the AMA says rising fees over and above what insurance companies pay out are being forced on doctors by the government when it froze medical rebates 5 years ago.
And 5 years of wages, of rents, of insurances, of all the other on-costs to providing that care have continued to be accumulated, whereas the rebate has frozen. And of course, does put pressure, and some doctors have no other opportunity but to not participate in that no-gap arrangement.
And that is the AMA President, Tony Bartone. And in news just in, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has just announced Australia will take part in an international effort in the Strait of Hormuz. Australia will join the US and the UK to keep trade routes open in the region. The contribution is set to include Australian Defence Force planning and operations staff, surveillance aircraft and a Navy frigate. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ruby Jones, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
This morning, Cardinal George Pell fronts court hoping that he'll be walking out a free man.
He's appealing a conviction that he sexually abused two choir boys in the 90s.
He's been behind bars since that verdict was handed down in March, and today we'll find out whether or not his appeal has been successful.
Today on The Signal, how we got to this point and how today's appeal will be decided.
Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.